The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. What comes to mind when you think of William Shakespeare? Well, some of you no doubt may say, well, I remember his home's located in a town, Stratford-on-Avon in England. Well, that's right. Well, as the headline for our first article suggests, that may not be entirely accurate. Yep. It says 460 years ago, Shakespeare was born here or somewhere. This written by Elizabeth Winkler and appearing in the April 23rd, 2024 New York Times. Now, subheads and some photo captions reveal that every year millions flock to Stratford-upon-Avon, England, to visit the house known as Shakespeare's birthplace. But was he really born here? A whole industry depends on it, state the editors. Now included is a black-and-white photo of a dilapidated three-story Tudor-style house with a steep shingled roof, a building believed to be Shakespeare's birthplace, before it was removed in the late 1800s. That's when the building was bought and renovated, and at the time of the sale, a British magazine called it a shabby sausage shop. Say that a few times. Anyway, let's find out what Elizabeth Winkler has to say as we continue. Sometime in the late 18th century, a sign appeared outside a shambly butcher's hut in the English town of Stratford-upon-Avon. The immortal Shakespeare was born in this house, states the sign, using then a common spelling of his name. Devotees began making pilgrimages, dropping to their knees, weeping, singing odes, untouched and sacred be thy shrine, Avonian Willie, bard divine. Well, a tradesman grew rich selling carvings from a local mulberry tree like pieces of the true cross. Some skeptics suspected that the sign was really part of a scheme to bring visitors to Stratford. Others wondered if it had been hung by the property's occupant. A local antiquarian criticized the whole scene as a design to extort pecuniary gratuities from the credulous and unwary. Well, pilgrims flocked to the house, and it became a sight so hallowed that one visitor warned that the veneration of Shakespeare threatened to eclipse that of God. And then we have this image that says, "Yet steals a sigh as reasons weigh the fame to Shakespeare given that thousands worshippers of him, and forget to worship heaven," they say. Well, about 250 years after its break from the Catholic Church, England had its own Bethlehem and manger. The problem, no one really knows where Shakespeare was born. Now we move into the next section, mock tutors and magic wands. Stratford-upon-Avon lies 2 hours northwest of London in the Midlands, more or less the heart of England. Today it is one of Britain's most popular tourist attractions, drawing up to 3 million visitors a year. The birthplace is the main attraction, followed by the cottage reputed to be the place where Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife, grew up. Stratford exudes Elizabethan quiche with souvenir shops and half-timbered buildings. In the 19th century, the Victorians tried to make Stratford look more authentic, which has left it teeming with mock tutors. It's a town whose economy and identity revolve around the Shakespearean fever, which peaks every year on April 23rd. That's the date celebrated as Shakespeare's birthday. It also, conveniently, St. George's Day, honoring the patron saint of England. And then we have another photograph that shows a sign with a depiction of a thatched cottage and reading Hathaway tea rooms. It hangs from a brown and white Tudor-style building with a steep slope roof. And yet another image that says businesses with Shakespeare-themed names, like this one linked to Anne Hathaway, his wife, line the streets of Stratford-upon-Avon. We continue with the article. On my first visit in June 2021, I passed the Hathaway tea rooms and a cafe called The Food of Love, a cutesy name given from Twelfth Night, parentheses, if music to be the food of love, play on, parentheses, quoting from Shakespeare himself. Confusingly, there were also several Harry Potter-themed shops, Stratford and Hogwarts, quills, wands, poems, and spells. Well, then again, maybe the conflation was apt. Wasn't Shakespeare a sort of boy wizard magically endowed with inexplicable powers? On Henley Street, I arrived at the birthplace, a half-timbered house yellowed with age. Today, it looks like a single detached building, but it was originally a row of tenements. John Shakespeare bought one tenement on the street in 1556, though he also bought property on nearby Greenhill Street, which could just as easily have been the site of his son's birth. He bought the property, thought to be the birthplace, in 1575, 11 years after his son was born. Those who believe in the birthplace point to a record from 1552 showing that a John Shakespeare was fined for keeping a dung heap somewhere on Henley Street. It doesn't specify the location, but that dung heap has fueled a theory that he must have been living there at the time of his son's birth, perhaps as a renter. Similarly, the claim for the authenticity of Anne Hathaway's cottage rests on a record that a John Hathaway leased the 90-acre farm on which the building stood 13 years before Anne was born in about 1556. The cottage may be linked to the Hathaways, but there is no proof that Anne actually grew up in it, just as there's none that Shakespeare was born in the house on Henley Street. Together, these traditions have sustained Stratford tourist industry, worth about $315 million in 2019 before the pandemic, but they have not convinced many skeptics over the years. Stratford permits, indeed encourages, one of the biggest frauds in England to rage unchecked, the journalist Bernard Levin railed in the Daily Mail in 1965. He writes, "I mean those two monumental frauds, Shakespeare's birthplace and Anne Hathaway's cottage." It didn't help the hucksters to have found ways to make the story profitable. In the early 19th century, a tenant of the birthplace named Mrs. Hornby ran a lucrative hustle showing and selling Shakespeare's relics to gullible visitors. The relics were eventually exposed in an 1848 article in Bentley's Miscellany, which observed that four different chairs, each purported to be Shakespeare's chair, had been sold over the years, each made by a well-known local craftsman. And then we go on to another photo. It shows a wide yellow and brown three-story half-timbered building with several sets of paned windows and a steep gabled roof. Above one of the doors hangs a yellow shield with a black bar diagonally crossing it. And then another photo caption shows extensive renovations in the late 1800s, turning the property on Henley Street into a home of a prosperous Elizabethan family, or what people at the time imagined that to be. Continuing with the article, "I entered through the Shakespeare Center, a strange museum that acts as an antechamber to the birthplace. There were no books owned by Shakespeare or letters in Shakespeare's hand because none are known to exist. Instead, a glass case displayed eight Shakespeare busts dating from 1844 to 2000. Another case featured a Shakespeare beer mug, 1933, Shakespeare playing cards, 1974, and a Shakespeare action figure made in China, 2003. Well, inside the birthplace, I went from room to room with other visitors. Guides regaled us with tales of Shakespeare's childhood, how he played and ate and dreamed in these rooms. Of course, his childhood is actually a yawning blank. From his baptism in 1564 to his marriage in 1582, there are no records of him. In one room, a table displayed the books, quills, ink, and indicating a family of learning, but his parents signed documents with a mark, like many illiterate people in Tudor England. That's where we get the famous X signature from. Now, the other visitors murmured to one another in reverent museum whispers and nodded at the guides. I thought of how in the late 19th century, a birthplace custodian named Joseph Skipsey resigned his post after a few months, explaining not a single one of the many so-called relics on exhibition could be proved to be Shakespeare's, and that the birthplace itself is a matter of grave doubt. And then we have a couple of more images. The captions read, "A set of two photographs depicting William Shakespeare. On the left, a white bust of Shakespeare stands in the window of a liquor store surrounded by bottles, including Jester Rum. On the right, a sign for an ice cream shop shows a cartoon illustration of Shakespeare wearing a ruff, holding a white and red soft-serve ice cream cone in one hand and a skull in the other." And then finally, the caption reads, "Stratford upon Avon abounds with Elizabethan quiche, like a Shakespeare bust in the window of one liquor store and the Hamlet-inspired sign for the ice cream seller." So, lots of fun there, huh? Next section, the power of popular faith. Efforts to preserve the property as the official birthplace began in 1847 when it was put up for sale. in response to fears that P.T. Barnum was going to buy it and make it part of a show, a committee was formed to save the house for the nation, and the group began to solicit donations. Not everyone was convinced. The extraordinary sensation caused by the purchase of this shabby sausage shop deserves a prominent place amongst popular delusions, declared the 1848 Bentley's Miscellany article. A writer for another British periodical mocked the gullibility of a nation pouring forth funds to buy a rubbishing mass of lath and plaster in which the poet was no more born than he was the man in the moon himself. But the belief had already become an article of faith, strengthened by its own reputation. The birthplace was a better shrine for the very absence of evidence for the faith it required of its visitors. The publisher, Charles Knight, wrote at the time, that same year the committee secured a birthplace at auction for £3,000, today worth about $323,000. Add a couple of more photo captions here. A street lined with red and brick and yellow and brown half-timbered buildings, there is a bronze-colored statue of William Shakespeare standing atop a pedestal. The Shakespeare statue is wearing a wide-collared shirt buttoned up to the neck and a cape over one shoulder, along with tights and high boots. People clad in light jackets are walking around in the street near the statue. And then Henley Street, one place in Stratford-upon-Avon where Shakespeare's father owned property, the birthplace which now looks like a single detached home, was a row of tenements in the mid-1500s, as we read earlier. Now we continue with the article, The Shabby Sausage Shop Made an Uninspiring Temple. So the adjoining premises were demolished, walls moved, floorboards replaced, new doorways and staircases created. Its new stewards transformed it into the large, comfortable home of a prosperous Elizabethan family, leaving the cellar as the only portion which remains as it was, as the scholar Sidney Lee wrote in 1901. What emerged was less a Tudor dwelling than a Victorian imagination of one. The committee became the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, the group that still runs the site and maintains its authenticity. We know that to the rest of our current understanding, the building includes the surviving fabric of a property that is traditionally and intimately associated with Shakespeare and his family, said a spokesman for the trust. The trust went on to acquire more properties, including Anne Hathaway's cottage, a thatched farmhouse where visitors are invited to relive Shakespeare's love story. A thatched cottage with brick and half-timbered walls and three chimneys surround a short picket fence and hedges, as seen in yet another photograph, and still another showing the property known as Anne Hathaway's cottage, where visitors can relive Shakespeare's love story. Records link the cottage to the Hathaways, but there's no proof that Anne grew up there. Now we go on to the temple to baby Shakespeare. This is the room where we believe William Shakespeare was born in April 1564, reads a sign in the birth room. Next to the bed, a cradle laid out with blankets and a tiny pillow, encouraging visitors to imagine the baby genius mewling by his parents' side. For the Victorians, the birth room offered the mystical possibility of contact with the poet. Visitors recorded melodramatic accounts of what they felt on entering the room. They burst into tears. They fell down. They kissed the floor. Those desiring a more extended communion spent the night. Others were unimpressed. If I were to allude to Stratford, it would not be in connection with the fact that Shakespeare came into the world there, wrote the novelist Henry James after visiting. It would be rather to speak of a delightful old house near the Avon, which struck me as the ideal home for a Shakespearean scholar. But the fantasy is resilient. In a 2023 PBS documentary, Making Shakespeare, the First Folio, the scholar Michael Dobson, director of the Shakespeare Institute, stood in the birthplace gushing over the very room in which Shakespeare was born. And I shuffled around the cradle with other visitors, unsure of what to do. We were supposed to genuflect, kiss it. After an appropriate amount of staring, we moved on. And still another photograph, several heart-shaped refrigerator magnets, four of them, with images of Shakespeare's birthplace and Anne Hathaway's cottage, along with a sketch of Shakespeare. One of the magnets reads, Stratford-upon-Avon, home of Shakespeare. And then two others have an image of the birthplace in the heart of a phrase reading, "I heart Shakespeare." Well, we have yet another photo and refrigerator magnets for sale at Stratford-upon-Avon. Now, in 2019, before the pandemic, tourism was worth about $350 million to the town, so they sold a lot of magnets, didn't they? Now, back to the article. To exit, I had to pass through the gift shop, where any lingering sense of piety dissipated in a tidal wave of consumerism. Well, that's one way to put it. Visitors were loading up on Shakespeare T-shirts, breakfast tees, and tea towels. Shakespeare rubber ducks and wind-up toys also there. And then we have Shakespeare Christmas ornaments, baby onesies, tote bags, and luxury chocolates. Belief is good business. When I returned to Stratford last February, little had changed since my first visit. The Shakespeare Center was now showing modern artist interpretations of the poet, including a surrealist painting of a masked figure that suggested the mystery surrounding him. The trinket stands were still hawking their modern versions of those 18th century mulberry tree carvings. Faith in the traditions is bound up with desire, the need to believe. Where was the immortal Shakespeare really born? Well, stories are usually more seductive than the truth. And by the way, Sheila McNeil contributed to this story. And to let you know, the author, Elizabeth Winkler, is a journalist, critic, and author of Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies, How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature is the name of her book. So an interesting story there. Well, from Stratford-on-Avon, we're going to head to Rome for our next article, as one photo tells us. In a park-like area with spacious lawns, pathways, and shady trees, visitors sit or stand beneath the trees. Some are perched on a long, ancient stone cylinder, which is part of an ancient aqueduct. As Roberto Salomone's photo revealed, we are in the Park of the Aqueducts, a short distance from central Rome. These ancient aqueducts once supplied the Eternal City with water. They are now preserved. The article we're going to be reading is about Aqua Marcia, the longest of the city's aqueducts. It runs nearly 60 miles from its source to the countryside to the heart of ancient Rome. Now, writer David Laskin followed the course of the aqueduct in below and above ground. He has frequently visited Rome for more than four decades and has written numerous articles on the history, culture, and art and architecture of the Eternal City. Now we're going to read his article, Tracing the Long Winding Path of an Ancient Roman Aqueduct. It appeared in the April 24, 2024 issue of the New York Times. The stone arches loop solemnly over their shadows, some teetering above the grass, some sinking into it. It was a dazzling January morning, and I was standing in the Park of the Aqueducts, about 20 minutes by metro from central Rome. Here, the ruined arcades of six of the 11 aqueducts that once supplied the Eternal City with an astonishing volume of water, by some accounts, double the per capita water allotment of a typical 21st century American city, have been preserved. My aim was to trace the course of one of them, the Aqua Marcia, built between 144 and 140 BC by Julius Caesar's ancestor Quintus Marcius Rex. Hailed by Pliny the Elder as the most famous of all waters of the world for coldness and wholesomeness, the Marcia was also the longest of the capital's ancient aqueducts, running some 56.8 miles from source to city. Only about 6.2 miles stood above ground. Now, in the park, we have a photo of the aqueducts, and the stone arcades of aqueducts are a central feature of a classical Roman landscape that has appeared in iconic Italian films. You might have seen these, La Dolce Vita or La Grande Lebbezza. Now, I've always assumed that Rome's aqueducts were a kind of aerial plumbing, their water channeled atop arches, but the Marcia, like all classical aqueducts, ran largely underground. The water removed by force of gravity and arches and bridges, which were expensive and vulnerable to attack, were only used to span ravines, valleys, and other dips in the terrain that would have interrupted the flow. And the arcade of the Marcia is now dry, but the same water still feeds mountain springs east of the capital. And I might inject here that M-A-R-C-I-A, Marcia is how I'm doing it, just kind of it's a little easier to pronounce. It can also, and probably more correctly from a Latin interpretation, should be Marcia, but I'm going with Marcia for right now. And though it now travels through a modern network of tunnels and tubes, the water is still referred to by its ancient name and still considered Rome's best drinking water. And one of the series of arches that rose before me once carried the current to Rome, which one, however, is a good question. Now we go to the park of the aqueducts, and another image reveals, in a wide open grassy area, a group of young people talk and play around. Now behind them are some stone arcades of an aqueduct and numerous trees, all beneath a clear blue sky. And it says here in another caption, the Park of the Aqueducts is a favorite spot for locals to hang out. Now the article. The roughly 600-acre Park of Aqueducts has few signs, maps, or directions. Romans come here to jog and walk their dogs, mainly. The few tourists wander through a bucolic landscape, green, tranquil, its imposing ruins seemingly untouched by modernity, that has appeared in such iconic Italian films as, we've mentioned, La Dolce Vita and La Grande Bellezza. Now, Michele Alfonsi, McKay Alfonsi, this is a man, a lawyer who heads up Pons Iani, a volunteer group devoted to aqueducts, offered to guide me. See that, he said, pointing to a stone passageway atop massive arches? That's the specus of the aqua marcia. So we'll change the marcia here to go with the Latin. Specus is the Latin term for a roof channel built at a slight downward slope so that the water would run through it without gushing or puddling. This was nearly high enough to stand up inside. Next, uncovering the past one discovery at a time. We clambered up the keystone of the arch, now just a few feet above ground. When it was completed during the heyday of the Republic, the Marcia was the first aqueduct to bring water to the Capitolini, Rome's most sacred hill. A small fountain there has been chiseled with the words Aqua Marcia, but like modern Rome's taps, it spouts a mixture of water from five different founts. Now, to sample pure Marcia water, I need to travel to the source. And then that brings us to the next section, where is the water? Sextus Julius Frontus, the first century commissioner of the aqueduct, wrote that the fount of the Marcia is near the 36th milestone of the Roman road via Valeria, roughly 35 miles east of Rome. But I had been warned that the original trenches had been obliterated in 1870 when the Marcia's long defunct classical aqueduct was reincarnated as the Aqua Pia Antica Marcia. Now you'll get close, says Peter J. Eicher, author of Guide to the Aqueducts of Ancient Rome, by searching for Central Caseta Rosa Idrico on Google Maps. Now I found the caseta. It's a small red stucco house used by the modern aqueducts maintenance personnel at the edge of a green field. Aside from the inscription Aqua Pia Antica Marcia 1870 carved over the front door and the shed-like structure built above springs alongside the road, there was no indication that Rome's best drinking water originated here. I took in the rounded hills, hazy blue in the distance, and the Italian cypresses striping their shadows across a little-traveled two-lane highway. Where's the water? I asked a maintenance man, and he pointed down. The underground spring that Quintus Marcius Rex first channeled over 2,000 years ago still bubbled beneath this bucolic spot. The only way to plumb Marcius depths was to go spelunking, which is how, a few days later, I found myself clinging to an exposed tree root on the side of a ravine dropping to the Anine River east of Rome. Put your foot right there, Alfonso Diaz Bosch coaxed. Two more steps and we'll be at the Marcia Specus. Well, Mr. Diaz Bosch, a guide for the Sotterranei di Roma, which offers tours of Rome's underground treasures, was leading a jaunt into the ancient, now dry aqueduct channels buried near the town of Vicavero, about 8 miles west of the Marcia's source. 12 of us met at the Convento San Casamato, whose property contains the ruins, to suit up in hard hats and headlamps. Once we negotiated the hand and toe holes and were hunched into the shoulder-high specus, Mr. Biaz Boj pointed to a lozenge of light slanting down from a shaft. Teams of workers excavated these shafts every 15 meters. When they reached the proper depth, two teams dug toward each other laterally until they joined up, he said. And then we have an image that shows a group of people standing close together inside the shadowy underground stone channel of the ancient aqueduct, their heads almost hitting the stone ceiling, so that indicates how big they are. We continue with the article. We passed bats clinging to walls and quills attested to the presence of porcupines. Over the centuries, the Marchia's water had deposited multicolored bubbles and stripes of calcium on the concrete that Romans used to seal the spicus. Mr. Biaz Bose pointed to graffiti, scratched onto the concrete, mysterious crosses, doodles, and the possibly faked signature of Thomas Ashby, the British archaeologist and author of the 1935 book Aqueducts of Ancient Rome. After a lunch of lasagna, salt and bocca a la Romana, and roast potatoes at the convent, I had a drink from a spigot in the garden. Only later did I learn that Vicovero is inside the zone that receives the Marchia's water unadulterated. It was delicious and refreshing, though I can't say I detected much difference from the mixed water of central Rome. Next, we have Ponte Lupo, or Point Lupo. The Marchia surfaces on arches and bridges several times between Vicovero and the Park of the Aqueducts, most spectacularly at Ponte Lupo, about 10 miles south of Tivoli. This colossal bridge spanning a deep gorge has been in the hands of the Barberini family since 1633, when Pope Urban VIII acquired the surrounding estate. Guided tours reserved by email, and they give you an email address if you wanted to take this tour. It's pontelupo@gmail.com. That's PONTELUPO, pontelupo@gmail.com. And these are offered occasionally, these guided tours, and during the festivals held here in the summer. Fortunately for me, a friend in Rome had arranged a private visit. Ponte Lupo's present owner, the actor and activist Prince Urbano Barberini, was waiting for us at the unpaved access road. A trim, handsome man in his early 60s, the prince recounted the site's recent vicissitudes as he led us down a sloping meadow. When he regained title to the property after a long and legal battle, the field and stream around the bridge had been buried in rubbish and frequented by sex workers. I had seen images of Ponte Lupo, but nothing prepared me for its size and complexity. The original tough arches carried the Marchia across a steep ravine. Subsequent retaining walls and buttresses have transformed the bridge into a palimpsest of building styles. It's a difficult scramble, the prince said, gazing up to the precipitous, densely vegetated summit above a dry creek. Would you like to try? I add the rugged, tangled sides of the ravine. Maybe not. Good, the prince replied, smiling, and we strolled back to the highway. So, there we have some very interesting discussions about this and some of ancient Rome. And you can, if you're inspired to sip from the source of the water as the Romans do, you just put a cup under the one of the big noses of a statue that spout from gooseneck spigots all over town, and you'll get an idea of what the ancient Roman water tastes like. That, my friends, is going to end our journey on today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.